ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Prime Minister announces Australia will recognise Palestinian statehood. Also, the finishing touches being put on a new defence treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea. And when will owners of electric vehicles be forced to pay a special fee to help maintain our roads?
This is something that's been coming and is inevitable. And we think the appropriate thing is to make it universally applied to all road vehicles.
Prime Minister has announced today that Australia will formally recognise the state of Palestine at the UN General Assembly next month. Mr Albanese says the decision is part of a coordinated global effort to build momentum for a two-state solution, which he says is humanity's best chance to break the cycle of violence in the Middle East. France, the UK and Canada have all made similar commitments in recent weeks, but advocacy groups on both sides of the debate are condemning Australia's move. Tanya Dendrinos prepared this report.
Australia will recognise the state of Palestine.
Anticipation for this announcement has been mounting for weeks. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese this afternoon confirmed Australia will recognise Palestinian statehood at the UN General Assembly next month.
When we recognise the long-held and legitimate aspirations of the people of Palestine, we are also upholding and strengthening our commitment to the people of Israel and their right to live in freedom, security and safety.
The move is subject to commitments the government has received from the Palestinian Authority, which currently runs the West Bank but not Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas.
Our government has made it clear that there can be no role for the terrorists of Hamas in any future Palestinian state. This is one of the commitments Australia has sought and received from President Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority has reaffirmed it recognises Israel's right to exist in peace and security. It has committed to demilitarise and to hold general elections.
While he spoke of the atrocities committed by Hamas on October 7, 2023 and called for the release of Israeli hostages, Anthony Albanese also called Israel's own actions into question.
The Netanyahu government is rapidly expanding illegal settlements. Settler violence in the West Bank has increased. There have been threats to annex the occupied Palestinian territories and proposing the permanent forced displacement of the Palestinian people.
The Prime Minister says these actions risk putting a two-state solution out of reach for a generation. The majority of UN nations, including China, India, Russia, South Africa and Norway, already recognise the state of Palestine, but major Western countries are yet to follow suit. Over the past few weeks, France, the UK and Canada have said they'd recognise Palestinian statehood at the UN meeting in September, a move the Israeli government has labelled a reward for Hamas. Experts say only Israel's closest ally, the US, can add significant weight to the push for recognition of a Palestinian state. Early this morning, prior to the announcement from the Australian government, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had this to say about the growing chorus.
To have the European countries and Australia march into that, march into that rabbit hole, just like that, fall right into it and buy this canard. Is disappointing, and I think it's actually shameful, but it's not going to change our position.
Israel's ambassador to Australia says Australia's move to recognise a Palestinian state will undermine Israel's security. Meanwhile, the Executive Council of Australian Jewry, which has long supported a two-state solution, labelled today's announcement a betrayal and abandonment of the Israeli hostages. Alex Rivchen is the council's co-CEO.
I think the Jewish community views this as a punitive measure taken against Israel in a desperate time for the country. It will view it as an abandonment of an ally, And it raises so many questions that really weren't answered by the Prime Minister or the Foreign Minister. They spoke about the fact that Hamas can play no role in the future governance of the Palestinian territories, but they didn't talk about how that's going to be achieved.
Alex Rivchen says the Executive Council of Australian Jewry shares many of the concerns of the international community when it comes to the dire situation faced by Palestinians in Gaza. But he fears the decision by the Australian government will have unintended consequences.
I think this might lead to a response from Israel that might be counterproductive. I think that the Palestinian Authority will view this as a huge gift. When it has sat inept and corrupt and quite extreme in its ideology as well. Hamas will view this as a huge boon for their ideology and their murderous ways. And I think domestically we'll see the most extreme elements of the anti-Israel movement view this as vindication.
Concerns have been voiced by the federal opposition too. Angus Taylor is the shadow treasurer. He says there's a risk this is rewarding terrorism.
The issue here that we're talking about is not the military strategy of Israel, it's the recognition of Palestine. And that's the issue I'm focused on. And it's long been agreed that preconditions are necessary for that to be successful and to lead to a lasting peace. Those preconditions haven't been met.
The Australian Palestine Advocacy Network is also disappointed in the announcement, but for vastly different reasons. It says the move deflects attention from the urgent obligation Australia has to help end the war. The Australia Palestine Advocacy Network's president is Nasser Mashni.
I was hoping that after hundreds of thousands of people rallied across the Sydney Harbour Bridge last week, after a National Day of Actions being called, after rallies all over the country over the weekend, that the urgency of Australians' demands of their representatives would look like sanctions, would look like an end to two-way military trade, would look like a rejection from our government of any sort of performative recognition. What Palestinians need is an end to the slaughter.
Beyond this, he says it's not up to Australia to decide a future for Palestinians.
What self-determination looks like in the future is for Palestinians to decide, not for Australia. Australia has a role to play as a middle power, as a member of the G20, to force Israel to comply with international law and ensure that we are not, that Australia is not, complicit in and culpable in this genocide.
But other Palestinian representatives are supportive. The General Delegation of Palestine to Australia has welcomed the move, calling it a significant and historic step towards achieving justice, peace and the long overdue realisation of the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and sovereign, independent statehood.
Tanya Dendrinos. Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University. He's welcomed the Prime Minister's announcement that Australia will recognise a Palestinian state at the UN next month.
Not because of any naivety that this is a panacea or it's going to make all the problems go away, but every other approach has been tried. The critics will say that this is putting the cart before the horse, that we should solve the problems in Israel-Palestine before recognising a Palestinian state. Obviously, the October 7th attack of 2023 was an outrageous, terrorist, obscene provocation. But I don't see this recognition of a Palestinian state, you know, it's symbolic. I don't think it rewards Hamas. Rather, it's a small but necessary step in opening the way for political negotiations. And it's pretty clear by this point that nothing is going to change if it's left to this current extremist Israeli government to take charge. It's going to take a community of nations bringing pressure to bring about change, and this is part of that pressure.
Why do you believe it isn't a win for Hamas?
Well, because Hamas, everyone involved in this is saying Hamas has no role to play in the future of a Palestinian state, whether it's Gaza or beyond. A couple of years ago, you could conceive of Hamas being involved in a negotiated solution, but the terror attack of October 7th completely excluded them. They're thoroughly discredited. And their behaviour over the last 22 months, bringing so much pain and suffering on the people of Gaza, has completely discredited them. I mean, they will try and spin it as some sort of victory, but it's not going to be to their advantage.
You say it's a symbolic step. So is it going to bring us any closer to a two-state solution?
That's the hope. I mean, the two-state solution is a process. We clearly have been on a trajectory which is a dead end, literally and figuratively. It's you know, going nowhere. To get back on the path towards a two-state solution requires putting pressure on the Israeli government and saying that 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Jews cannot live in the same land side by side without some sort of negotiated political solution that recognizes the people of Palestine as well as the people of Israel. It's not good for the people of Israel any more than the people of Palestine to not have this work done.
The Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese, says he's received undertakings from the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, including that there be no role for Hamas in a future Palestinian state, demilitarisation, recognition of Israel's right to exist. Do you think we can have any confidence that the Palestinian Authority will make progress on these undertakings?
Well, the current Palestinian Authority is moribund. It has no capacity to exercise leadership. So it needs to be reinvented and rebuilt itself. But no one's denying that. I don't think anyone seriously looking at this suggests that we simply reactivate current Palestinian Authority and then it's in a position to do the work that it needs to do. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of bringing in fresh leadership, fresh accountability, fresh capacity. It's really hard, but it still remains the case that something that comes out of the current Palestinian administration authority is the best way forward of representing the Palestinian people and excluding extremist groups like Hamas. So there has to be a way found, but we don't have the raw materials right now as it is. There's going to have to be a lot of work bringing in new leaders and bringing in new mechanisms, reinventing the Palestinian Authority.
So this work, obviously, in reforming the Palestinian Authority won't be done by next month. What happens if countries like Australia, the UK, Canada and France recognise a Palestinian state, but those reforms never eventuate?
Well, we've had decades of that sort of tragedy, so that is a risk. This move of recognising a Palestinian state that's symbolic has the potential to break that deadlock and set things off in a productive direction, but it's not a guarantee. There's going to have to be a lot of concerted effort. You know, potentially a future American government can play a positive role. The current American government, for various reasons, doesn't have the capacity to play that role, so it'll have to be the international community without relying on the American government and without relying on this current extremist government in Israel, and that seems like a really unreasonable situation, but that's the reality we face.
Will recognition of a Palestinian state by several Western democracies have any effect, do you think, on the position of President Trump and the United States when it comes to a two-state solution?
Potentially in time. And President Trump, of course, is famously transactional and does care about his popularity, the way he's seen, particularly on television. So you can imagine a situation in which this contributes to this particular administration in Washington responding and changing. But certainly future governments are going to be in a different position. I mean, the reality is more than three quarters of the 193 UN member states, 147 of the 193 member states currently recognize Palestine. The holdouts are, for the most part, Western democracies. So when key Western democracies, middle powers, move to say, we recognize we're going to have to do something differently, that's very consequential, at least potentially so.
Do you think there's a risk that the move by Australia and the other Western democracies to recognise a Palestinian state will see the United States back Israel with even more determination?
There's a risk, but I mean, you'd have to ask yourself the practical question, what more could the US do to back this current government in Israel? I mean, the tragic damage in terms of bombardment in Gaza has come largely from US-supplied heavy weapons. There's been no slowdown of that, whether it was the Biden administration or the Trump administration.
Professor Barton, do you think it's likely Australia will be punished by the United States in some way for taking this step in September?
I think there's a possibility that Donald Trump will spin some action on that basis, but the reality is this administration of the second Trump administration has been a very unreliable international partner to its closest friends. And I think we've got to the point where we can't act in fear of a bully. We have to do what we believe to be the right thing. We need to take the lead and work collectively with other like-minded nations and say, let's try and find a solution together and then bring America around to supporting this rather than wait for America to lead.
Greg Barton is a professor of global Islamic politics at Deakin University. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has been in Papua New Guinea today as the countries finalise a new bilateral defence treaty. The pact is expected to be signed around the time of the 50th anniversary of PNG's independence next month. It comes as Australia tries to build stronger ties in the Pacific region to counter the rise of China. Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. Stephen, what's happened today at these discussions?
Well, Sam, the main purpose of the minister's visit today was to hand over 12 armoured land cruisers to the Papua New Guinea Defence Force at Murray Barracks. That's the latest commitment Australia's made to really try and bolster the defence capability of Papua New Guinea. It's also doing a huge amount of work across both the land forces as well as Papua New Guinea's embryonic air force. And then on top of that, we're expecting the minister to head to Lombrum Naval Base. That's a major naval base that Australia has worked with a number of others to substantially upgrade. We're expecting that new upgraded naval base to effectively be opened by Richard Miles tomorrow. So that's essentially Australia doing everything possible to telegraph the amount of time, money and resources that it's ploughing into that relationship at a time of really intense strategic contest in the region. And then, of course, we're also expecting Mr. Miles and Billy Joseph, the PNG Defence Minister, to hold another round of discussions over the defence treaty that the two sides have been negotiating for about 7 or so months now. And interestingly, we heard from Billy Joseph today that they are on track to complete those negotiations by September 16 next month. That's the 50th anniversary of Papua New Guinea's independence. Mr. Joseph said Australia and PNG hope to finalise those discussions by then in order to put pen to paper. So that's a pretty rapid turnaround for what is a pretty substantial agreement.
And Stephen, do we know much about the terms of that defence pact?
No, very little. And in fact, Richard Miles was asked about what the defence pact might include today, and he simply said that they would get into those discussions closer to the date, or that he would make those details public either immediately before or after signature. There has been a lot of speculation about what's going to be in this agreement. One thing we do know that it will probably allow or facilitate is making it possible for PNG to send people to Australia to serve in the Australian Defence Force. Like many armies, the Australian Army has been struggling with shortfalls and has been looking to find new and novel ways to boost recruitment. PNG, of course, is a very populous country, struggles with under and unemployment. So it's possible that there would be a pathway through the treaty to potentially see hundreds or even thousands of people from PNG serving in the ADF. The other question that we're looking at the moment is, are we going to see any sort of mutual defence commitment inside this agreement? Would Australia and Papua New Guinea, for example, agree to consult with each other in the event of either facing an armed attack from a hostile exterior force? At this stage, though, Sam, we simply don't know. We'll have to wait and see what's unveiled in just a little bit over a month.
Stephen Jedgetts is the ABC's foreign affairs reporter. The push for owners of electric vehicles to start paying a special road usage fee appears to be gaining momentum. At the moment, motorists pay an excise on every litre of fuel they buy to help pay for maintenance of the road network. But because EV owners don't buy fuel, they don't pay that fee. Now the federal government says it's considering a new model to make the system more equal. Miles Horbrook-Walk has more.
It's fair to say Peter Campbell was an early adopter of electric vehicles compared to most motorists.
Well, I've had several EVs. My first EV was a car I converted to electric drive back in 2009. So I've been driving EVs for, 16 years?
But he, like every other EV owner, could eventually find himself having to pay a specific fee for using the roads.
We think the appropriate thing is to make it universally applied to all road vehicles in order to avoid having a chilling effect on the uptake of EVs. There are various ways it might be introduced, but we're not adamantly opposed.
The possibility has been on the cards a long time. The issue is that right now, drivers of petrol vehicles pay an excise on fuel, which is used to cover the immense cost of maintaining roads. EV owners, on the other hand, don't pay that excise despite using the same roads. Today, when asked about a possible fee, government frontbencher Murray Watt indicated that while the policy is being considered, road users should not expect any changes in the near future.
I wouldn't want to jump ahead of any sort of decision making that's going to occur around that, but it's no secret that we've said previously that we'll be working with the states and territories on this matter, but it's probably a little bit premature to be saying exactly what will occur.
Meantime, opposition frontbencher Jane Hume has told Sky News that it's important all road users are contributing to the maintenance of roads.
Now, the rise of EVs is something that has happened exponentially in the last few years. We want to make sure that those EV users are making sure that they're responsible for road maintenance in the same way that petrol and diesel car users are.
Professor David Hencher from the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies at the University of Sydney thinks the idea of a road fee for EVs is sensible and that it could be applied to all vehicles.
The contribution to the cost of the roads as a result of the impact of congestion or non-congestion should be factored in somewhere.
The actual fee being paid could depend on where a vehicle is driving and even what time it's on the road, so as not to unfairly punish regional and rural drivers, according to David Hencher.
With smart technology you can now put into cars, you can track that. And in fact, if, for example, you're travelling in the highly congested peak hours in the cities, you might pay a higher cost because you're causing more damage through loss of time to others and so on and so on. But when you're out in the bush, the only issue is damage to the roads. The argument might be you pay a lower charge. So that can be worked out.
David Hencher says if you pursued this model, you could remove the fuel excise altogether and just have a road usage fee paid for by all drivers. He even has an estimate of what it might cost.
I think a figure that would actually be attractive to all users would average around 5 cents a kilometre. Say 10,000 kilometres of the year, then we're talking about maybe $500 a year or something like that. It's not a great deal of money considering the benefit that it would generate.
Complicating all of this, though, is the process by which a new tax, fee or excise could actually be introduced. In 2023, the High Court ruled the Victorian government's road user tax, which charged electric vehicle users based on how far they travel, was found to be unconstitutional. It prevented other states and territories from making similar laws thereafter, meaning the final decision remains with the federal government.
Miles Holbrook-Walk reporting. In Queensland, Australian researchers have revitalised critical sea life habitat, which was damaged by wild weather in 2017. Successive cyclones decimated seagrass meadows in the Whitsunday Island area, putting the survival of species like the dugong and particular turtles at risk. Kathleen O'Connor filed this report.
In the Pacific Ocean off Queensland's central coast is one of the seven wonders of the world. Turtles are one of the star attractions on the Great Barrier Reef, but lately their numbers have been dwindling. Dale Tansley is a reef tour operator.
Well, with the seagrass, we get all sorts of different creatures out there too, like including the dugongs as well. I used to see them for a while, probably I'd see them every 2 weeks, about 2 or 3 days in a row. But lately, they haven't been around for the last 3 months. I've seen them once in the last 3 months. But the turtles, I've seen every time we go out. We've got a 100% success rate at seeing the turtles because they come in there because of the seagrass.
The Great Barrier Reef is home to the largest seagrass ecosystem in the world. The meadows are a critical habitat for turtles, but they were damaged by wild weather in 2017. Since then, scientists have been fighting to save the seagrass. Alexandra Williams from the Australian Marine Conservation Society is part of the restoration program called the Sea Grassroots Project.
So a number of seagrass meadows in the region were affected by Cyclone Debbie, and from that there was a clear need to go in and look to how best to protect those meadows and how to restore them. That's where the research comes in, led by Central Queensland University. The species of seagrass, which is found most widely distributed along the east coast of Australia, Zostrum mulleri, that's been the predominant species in which the university has been doing restoration work on.
The meadows have been long susceptible to the weather, but their stunted growth over the past decade has pushed researchers to act. It's a 3-year community-driven initiative to improve the health and resilience of inshore habitats, starting with the tourist hotspot of Airlie Beach. The team collects grass at low tide. The seagrass seeds are then cultivated and grown in purpose-built nurseries. Mud balls stacked with seeds are rolled at the nursery before being taken out to the shallow bay to plant in the hopes it will regenerate the grass. Alexandra Williams says it's important to get as many people as possible involved.
Seagrass absolutely support the protection of the coastline. They stabilise sediments through their dense root system, compacting all the sediment, and with increasing storm activity, it basically just protects the coastline and traps sediment runoff, is prevented from going out into the reef because of having those seagrass habitats in place.
That's Alexandra Williams from the Australian Marine Conservation Society. That report from Kathleen O'Connor and Liam O'Connell. Thanks for your company this evening. I hope you have a very good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Elon Musk hasn't fully embraced the idea, and he doesn't want Teslas used for it. But some electric vehicles are already being plugged in to provide power to homes and even to the grid. Today, energy reporter Dan Mercer on the revolutionary technology and why the world's richest man is wary of it. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.